Session number 13265, wheel number 10.
When I was called to the orderly room and given the posting, the orderly room clerk said, well, he said, you don't have to get into Gloucester for another 4 days or so. But he said, but you might as well go now. He said, get your clearance. And he said, go now. He said, there's no point in you staying here. He said, and as long as you arrive on time, he said, I don't care where you get to in between times, which, of course, means that you can go home, effectively. So he gave me a travel warrant and dated it on the day I left the station, left Dyce, and dated to suit my arrival down at Gloucester. So I went down to the railway station in Aberdeen to get on a train which would take me down via Edinburgh and York and Sheffield to Chesterfield. And there was a miserable, narrow-gutted railway inspector on duty, and he looked at my travel warrant and informed me that I couldn't go that route because my travel warrant said by the shortest route, Aberdeen-Gloucester. And that meant Aberdeen and possibly Edinburgh, but then Crewe, Birmingham, Gloucester, that way. And he wouldn't let me onto the platform for the train I wanted. Well, had I gone on the York train, I'd have been home that night. No trouble at all. I'd have been home in the afternoon, possibly. Certainly by 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. So I very miserably struggled over onto the other platform, carrying my kit bag and gear, got on the train, and got into Crewe somewhere, as I recall, I think it must have been a Sunday morning. Got into Crewe somewhere about 11 o'clock, midnight, I don't know. And the next train out to anywhere, as far as I could see, was somewhere about 6 or 7 o'clock. I ended up going from Crewe to Manchester to Sheffield Central, and then I think walking from Sheffield Central to Sheffield LMS station with my gear, and finally getting into Chesterfield sometime about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Might even have been later. I know it felt as though I'd been travelling forever. That was leaving, I'd left the station at Dyce something like 9:30, 10 o'clock the previous day. I was absolutely choked. Anyway, just one of those things. Get down to Innsworth and report in, get onto the station, and as I say, 8 weeks course, pass out, posted to headquarters flight, Linton-on-Ouse. Well, I thought, oh, headquarters flight, that might be quite a nice little number. Two or three aeroplanes, flying communications, different aeroplanes, get home 48 hour pass fairly regularly, quite nice, thinks I. Headquarters flight, says the station, the SB at the guard room. We haven't got a headquarters flight. Yes, you have, said I. I'm posted to it. No, we haven't. I've been here a couple of years. He says, we haven't got a headquarters flight. Yes, you have, I said. I'm posted to it. So he decides to get on the horn to station headquarters. Ah, yes, yes. Station headquarters flight, number, what was it? Number 2 hangar, something of that order. Second from the left when you're looking from SHQ towards the hangars. Report down to number 2 hangar. Okay, so I wander down there. It's a long walk, carrying a kit bag and gear and whatnot. and hunt around and find an office. And there's a flight sergeant. Yes, he says, this is headquarters flight. He said, but we're going to be 35 Squadron. He said, the headquarters flight is just a cover name so that nobody knows what we're doing. And he said, that's what we've got. Takes us into the hangar there, and there's a dirty great Halifax standing up. This is end of November, beginning December, 1940. Well, even if you've seen and flown in a Harrow, a Halifax looks awful big, when it, especially when it's standing in a hangar, and especially when it's the first four-engine bomber you've seen in real life. And we were slightly taken aback. And it reminded me of a point I missed when I was telling you about 83 Squadron, arriving at 83, right in September 39. A group of us who'd arrived at Scampton at the same time, we were taken down to the hangar and taken into the hangar and shown the aircraft. Well, we looked at the Hamptons and thought marvellous, but one of the party, an older chap, simply looked at them and he said, bloody hell, he said, I can't work on them. He says, the last kite I worked on was an FE-2B, which was an aircraft designed in 1914-13 and served right through the war. He was an electrician. He'd been on FE-2Bs where they were about as much electrics as you could use on a pocket torch. You know, all old-fashioned lighting with the old brass switches, well, such as you have on the wall, that kind of gear. And so he looked at the Hampton and he decided it wasn't for him and promptly vanished. Next time I saw him, he was on a charge. He'd been carefully avoiding duty for nearly 2 months and just walking around the station, living in barracks and getting his meals and so on, but never turning up for any parades or duties. And he'd arranged it. So he'd signed in to places that were necessary. He was an old soldier, see, Classic Reserve. He'd signed in to all the places that he needed to be, but he hadn't signed in to anywhere where he got his name on the duty list. Rather neat, I thought that was. Anyway, there we are with Halifaxes, and we begin to think, oh well, now it looks as though the service is beginning to look up. We're going to dish something out for a change. And so we begin to work. There's no maintenance flight, there's no A and B flight or anything of this order as yet. We've only got, I think, 3 or 4 aircraft. And we have to get down to getting used to the aeroplane service, general servicing. And the aircraft are so new that, of course, there are an awful lot of things going to crop up once we get them flying. And later in December, by this time our numbers have increased with postings in from various places. And the CO calls a parade in the hangar, a squadron parade, and he informs us that this is the inaugural parade of 35 Squadron. We are now officially 35 Squadron. We change our address, postal addresses, to our folks, and we become 35 Squadron on the station, so on. And he gives us a pep talk. These are going to be as he said, like the Handley Page 100s and 400s of the First War. I've forgotten the term that was used to describe the old 400. Strictly Anglo-Saxon. Anyway, I think he used a similar term.
You mean a swear word?
Nothing drastic, just... There was I don't know if it was Churchill or someone looked at at a Handley page over 400 and said, you know, a bloody great destroyer or something of that order, you know, a smasher, or it's in the literature, but my memory drops out on occasion. Anyway, we were going to be one of the first real squadrons to start bashing the German. I'd been aware of the Halifax since I'd been in 83, since 39, because some of the chaps in 83 had been on makers' courses on Hamptons down at Cricklewood and had seen the prototype Halifaxes there. One of them, I think, was still being finished when, or certainly they were still being built, I think, when at least one of the mods had been down on the course. So we knew the Halifax was there, and the squadron was a little bit disappointed that they weren't going to get them, because they knew that the next aircraft they were going to get, this is August, September 39, they knew that the squadron's next aircraft would be the Manchester. What they didn't know, of course, was what a disaster it was going to be when they got it. But it did mean, of course, that they went eventually onto Lancs, and they never had the Halley. Those of us who were keen on aircraft at all and kept our ears to the ground, we already knew in 1939 that the Stirlings and the Halifaxes and the Manchesters were on the way. And we knew that they were, the Stirling and the Halley were four-engine bombers, and that the Manchester was going to have Vultures. Secrecy in the services was reasonable, but if you were in the technical side, as in any service, the word simply gets around. You can't be stopped. As long as there are makers' courses being run by the service, then people go on them and they see what's being built and they talk, and technical people always talk anyway, because everybody wants to know what everybody else knows and what everybody else is doing. And so we knew quite a lot about the new stuff that was coming on. And because I was from Chesterfield, which is close to Hucknall and close to Derby, and people I knew in Chesterfield worked at Derby and so on, I was in the Chesterfield Model Engineering Society, or Model Aeroplane Club and whatnot at that time. The word got around. I'd already heard about the Rolls-Royce Vultures and the Rolls-Royce X and other engines, which were still really highly secret, but which were being test flown from Hucknall. And I suppose if I knew about it, then Jerry must have done. At least he would have done if he'd been working properly. I don't know. Anyway. So we set about making a squadron out of 35, and that meant that some of us had to fly as flight engineer on the training flying, because there were no flight engineers yet. There had been no official training schedule set up for flight engineers in the service, as far as I know, and pilots were coming to us having to be converted on the unit from whatever they'd been flying before, Whitleys or Wimpies, and they needed engineers so that the aircraft could fly, and so sergeant fitters and corporal fitters and LACs like myself, if we chose to volunteer, we could fly and stooge around on the conversion flying, which was mostly circuits and bumps. Fairly boring, except in winter when the runway gets icy and you've got idiots who are learning, who can't readily change over from flying a Whitley to a Halifax, where all the differences crop up. and it's a lot better to be up in the air in an aeroplane in winter than on the deck on a cold aerodrome waiting for it to come back. You know? Because of dispersals, the aircraft, at first we operated from in front of the hangars, but quite quickly, of course, the dispersal points were completed. Concrete runways had already were being completed. And we got there at first. I'm pretty sure that they weren't complete, because I can remember the squadron taking off on grass quite a lot. Or I may be wrong. I would make no hard and fast claim here. The runways may have existed. They did. Of course they did. Because when the heavy snowfall came and the station was snowed in, Ive Lord Chapman, the station master, had the whole station out there digging the runways clear. And when he'd got the runways clear, he discovered to his horror that the station now stood out like a sore thumb in White Yorkshire. And we had to shovel the snow back again. Meanwhile, we're cut off from York and from rations. We couldn't get bread through from the bakery. We're down to using ration biscuit. You know, those things like half tiles, with all their dreadful results. Like people bite on them and lose fillings and crowns. Moynihan, who was one of the chaps posted with me to the station, did that. He lost two crowns off his teeth. Did rather well out of it, because he had to go down into York to get them re-crowned, and so he got quite a bit of time off station on that swindle. But he was rather annoyed with me, because I'd bitten a piece off and he thought he could do it, and he did the same thing and lost them. Ended up having problems eating until the snow cleared. But if Ive Lord Chapman had had us dig the road out straight away instead of the runways, of course we'd never have had that problem. I wasn't very impressed with him, his attitude to the underlings. Later on in March, after the we'd had the order, greatcoats will cease to be worn. I mentioned that earlier, didn't I?
Yes.
So we'd had the order, greatcoats will cease to be worn, and it was a station CO's parade. That would probably be, at a guess, that might have been a Friday, but I don't know. It was really no different from the parade we held every morning before marching out, because Linton at this time was a fairly bull kind of station, pre-war station, and things were done fairly with a fair bit of bull. And so we're on parade at 8 o'clock, and between 8 o'clock and 8:30, the parade is due, the official parade is due to start at 8:30. Well, between 8 o'clock, when we all form up on the square, and 8:30, the officers come out in ones and twos and take their places, and we're all standing there like cheese at Fortin's, and it started to snow. And it snowed, and it snowed, and we stood there. And it was 9 o'clock before Ive Lord Chapman deigned to come out and take the parade, by which time we're all well plastered, no greatcoats, and we then have to stand there, and he has his parade, and then we can march off down to the hangars and begin to get on with the day's work, which I regarded as being slightly idiotic. Well, I could have used even harder words. I don't think it's the way men should be treated by any officer who's thinking about the job that's being done. This was a working station. It's not a training station, a bull station, you know. We didn't need training in discipline. We could all stand in muck and corruption and whatnot and just stand there and take it. Any fool can do that. But it's so damn pointless, isn't it?
Yes.
You know? And it, all it does is breed enormous resentment. I don't know how many people have resented I've Lord Chapman ever since, but I certainly did, because I thought it was, well, it's damn bad manners, much as anything else. After all, there was a whole stack of commissioned officers there, all wasting time and getting perished, wet through. Ridiculous. Some ooh nasties occur. Our first operational aircraft was 86. I can't remember. I always have to check. Go back to the reference books. L. The first two numbers. I can't remember whether they are 3, 4, or what they are, but 86 were the last two figures of the serial number, was our first one. We had 86, 87, probably 88 and 89 in sequence. We also at this time had 7244, which was the first prototype. 7244 first and 7245 the second prototype. First prototype had no turrets, no weapons, and also had the original fuel tanks, which I think were bag tanks. So that by comparison with subsequent aircraft, it was extremely light. As a consequence, it was also pretty fast. You could quite easily get to about 300 in it. All we needed to set it on the step, get the nose down, just a feather, and she was very fast. Anyway, so we had these aircraft, and because the station was operational with 58 Squadron, we were a bit limited as to the amount of circuits and bumps we could do at that time. I suppose 58 were fairly busy with doing training flying and so on, and operational flying. And so during the day, one or two of our aircraft would go over to Leeming and do circuits and bumps there, in amongst the squadron aircraft there, doing their NFTs and things like that. And we get the report that 87 has gone in. She was on finals on approach and simply dived into the deck. First words were that there was an explosion aboard, and so we have to go over there and we have to dig out all the bits and bring all the bits back and assemble them in the hangar. And then the word, the buzz gets around that somebody has left a fuel tank cap off, and this has caused the explosion. Well, for the sergeant, who at this time is the NCOIC of this aircraft, and those of us who are on the ground, on the crew of that aircraft, that's a bit of a blow, a bit of a knock, because we've signed for it. Well, I can't recall that we found a piece of tank with a tank cap missing. I still don't know what the decision was by the Court of Inquiry or the Inquiry, the Board of Inquiry, as to the cause of the crash. I do recall that there was talk of an explosion in the hydraulic system, and that there were hydraulic pipes found inflated, as though an explosion had occurred either within the pipes or in one of the hydraulic accumulators. But no one that I recall was charged, and the whole thing, after a while, it fizzed and bubbled and then seemed to just die a death. But we were all regarded, those of us who'd been on that crew, we were all sort of under shadow for some time, which was not very pleasant at all. We ran into problems with the hydraulic pumps on the Messier gear. The Halifaxes had the French Messier system installed. The hydraulic pumps were driven from the camshaft. I think I'm safe in saying it was the port side camshaft power takeoff on the Merlin, and the hydraulic pump was fitted there and driven using a conical clutch drive. As far as I can remember, this was probably the first time in the RAF that this type of thing had been done. The idea was that when the system was up to pressure, the clutch would declutch and relieve the load on the engine, which meant, of course, that the engine would be several horsepower better off, which means, of course, you reduce fuel consumption on long flights and so on. And that clutch and the setting, the setting of the hydraulic arrangements, balancing the pressure in the system and the pressure in the pump and one thing or another to operate the clutch, required some development and learning by the airframe fitters and so on, learning how to adjust them and get them right. Otherwise the thing started clutching in and out. You could hear it when the aircraft were flying. When you were aboard, you could hear the noise in the hydraulic system. And of course that meant that the clutch going in and out repeatedly wore the clutches out, and then you lost hydraulic power. And so that was a problem which required a deal of work. And somewhere about this time I was sent on the Messier course to Warrington, where the Rubroin firm had set up their factories producing the Messier components. It was very it was quite an impressive effort, that was. The oleo legs, which on most aircraft were simply finished by normal grinding processes, you know, simple straight rotary grinding processes. These were taken a step further by Messiers, and the oleo legs, the components, were lapped to a finish by laps which travelled horizontally. And I can't remember whether the lap itself rotated in steps or the leg was rotated within the lap, but the final finish was a longitudinal finish in terms of polishing grain. The finish on the surface of the metal, however microscopic, was largely longitudinal rather than transverse, and that meant, of course, that the hydraulic seals and everything else and the wear was likely to be considerably less. The friction is reduced as well. This was a very substantial undercarriage. The main legs were castings of magnesium, huge box castings. The wheel itself, the aircraft wheel, was of the order of nearly, certainly 4 foot 6 in diameter, thereabouts. And